You are listening to WPVM LP 103.7 in Asheville, North Carolina.
The voice of Chris Smith.
From Feature Story News in New Delhi, I'm Neha Punia. U.S. President Donald Trump has issued a fresh warning to Iran. With peace negotiations stalled, he's told Tehran the clock is ticking. His latest threats coming after he rejected Iran's response to the White House peace proposal. Alistair D'Souza has more.
Donald Trump, on his Truth Social account overnight, posted an AI-generated image. It warns of, quote, the calm before the storm. That particular AI-generated post, it shows the U.S. president surrounded by military vessels with lightning striking down from dark clouds above. So people trying to interpret what's going on here. Because all of this really coming in the midst of these media reports from the New York Times and also Fox News saying that the U.S. is weighing restarting strikes on Iran. Trump, as you know, has grown increasingly frustrated with Iran after Iran responded to that peace proposal sent by the U.S. Trump called it absolutely unacceptable. He told reporters on his return to China about how he apparently read the first line and he really didn't like that first line and just decided to throw it away.
An Ebola out.
And ideally, it's meant to mobilize resources and expertise. This Ebola outbreak has happened in an area that is grappling with a conflict. There are a number of armed groups that have been attacking civilians, forcing them to flee their homes and live in crowded camps. And that is an area that facilitates the spread of this infectious disease. Ituri province, where it's happened in the northeast of the DRC, is also an area that shares a border with Uganda and South Sudan. There's a lot of cross-border trade around that area. People keep moving from one area to another.
Boosting technology cooperation is at the top of the agenda as India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi continues his European diplomatic outreach. After signing a semiconductor manufacturing deal in the Netherlands, clean technology would be in focus as the Prime Minister visits Norway on Monday.
Green technology, energy cooperation and critical minerals could be just some of the items on the agenda as Prime Minister Narendra Modi meets his Norwegian counterpart this week. It's the first visit by an Indian Prime Minister to Norway in four decades and comes as New Delhi has been looking to reduce its trade dependence on the US and China. Mr. Modi will also participate in the India-Nordic summit on Tuesday. It comes after his visit to the Netherlands, where the Dutch semiconductor fabrication giant ASML signed a deal with India's Tata Electronics to build India's first fabrication plant. Ishan Garg, New Delhi.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks. We're going to spend some time today and tomorrow hearing the Chinese position on last week's state visit to Beijing by President Trump. On the face of it, the US leader did not get very far with President Xi Jinping. Much coveted trade deals were more limited than many of the CEOs accompanying the US leader had hoped. China was much more focused on drawing red lines for the US over the issue of Taiwan than White House officials may have anticipated. But what did China get out of the visit? Victor Gao is vice president of the Center for China and Globalization in Beijing.
Well, lots of things. First of all, President Trump restored the time-tested tradition of each sitting president of the United States ever since President Reagan making a state visit to China. And that tradition was broken by former President Biden. When he was president of the United States for 4 years, he didn't make a state visit to China. I would say President Biden was a Cold War president. His presidency was a Cold War presidency. And President Biden probably really didn't care about the fundamental interests of the American people.
Tomorrow, Taiwan, the toughest issue of all between Washington and China. Could it still completely derail the relationship and even spark a war between the United States and Beijing? We'll hear Victor Gao's views on those questions tomorrow. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
The main news again. With peace negotiations stalled, U.S. President Donald Trump tells Iran the clock is ticking, his latest threats coming after he rejected Iran's response to the White House peace proposal. An Ebola outbreak in Congo and Uganda has been declared a global health emergency by the World Health Organization. Boosting technology cooperation is top of the agenda as India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi continues his European diplomatic outreach. And that is the latest feature story news. Neha Punia reporting.
Here's your Radio Asheville weather report. Sunshine across the mountains today, high near 88 here in town. Winds could gust as high as 20 miles per hour. Mostly clear tonight, the low going down to 61. Sunshine on Tuesday with a high in the upper 80s to near 90. Partly cloudy for Tuesday night, a low around 62. Then a chance of showers and thunderstorms on Wednesday, and we'll see a high near 90. I'm Johnny Cottle on Radio Asheville 103.7.
Hello, folks. Thanks again for joining us on Head Inside Mental Health, featuring conversations about mental health and substance use treatment with experts, advocates, and professionals from across the country sharing their thoughts and insights on the world of behavioral health care. Broadcasting on WPVM 103.7, the voice of Asheville, independent commercial-free radio. I'm Todd Weatherly, your host, therapeutic consultant, and behavioral health expert. With me today and returning to the show is my good friend, Sarah Summey,
the chief executive officer of Lakewood Center, the therapeutic community to enhance the quality of life for adults living with chronic mental illness based in Greater Orlando. Sarah has an impressive background that spans various pivotal roles in the behavioral healthcare sector, including executive officer, senior director, and direct care clinical roles. Her extensive experience encompasses operational strategy, service recovery, and multi-facility oversight, and leading groundbreaking initiatives in assisted living programming and forging partnerships with esteemed institutions like the University of Central Florida and Rollins College. Beyond her professional achievements, Sarah is a passionate advocate for mental health and is actively involved in organizations such as the National Alliance for Mental Illness, NAMI, and the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, with a Master of Science in Healthcare Administration and certifications that underline her expertise. Sarah combines her professional knowledge with personal experiences that fuel her mission to enhance the access to mental health care for all, which is why I like her.
Have you seen this? Have you seen the movie Patrice on Hulu?
No.
Check it out.
What's it about?
So Patrice is a person with disabilities, and she lives with her partner, or they kind of live together with her partner because they can't get married, because if they get married, they lose their benefits.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Which is a huge issue, of course, in the...
Which really happens.
Yep. In the Medicaid, Medicare benefits world. Mm-hmm. And we see, you know, we're seeing a bunch of that, of course, right now, especially with housing.
For people.
If they got limited resources, they got limited income, you know, through disability, and they're truly disabled. And then, of course, what's the next thing they're talking about? They're talking about people who are disabled, and I don't know the parameters on this. I assume, you know, they're talking about you need to work a small amount of time, you know, part-time or something, some amount of hours in order to continue to get your benefits. It's like, so does that mean that my 84-year-old mother needs to go back to work? Like, is that what we're talking about? Because she's not going back to work.
And no offense, but like, as an employer, and you want to keep, like, we're talking about like economic hardship and why things cost so much. It's expensive to make all these special accommodations. And so we're like expecting companies and employers to subsidize disability benefits. Like, that's...
Yeah.
So all the accommodations I have to make for someone, which I can and I do, but that's, someone has to pay for that. So it's the consumer's going to pay for the expense of that, and I'm now subsidizing what should be provided anyways.
It's like Walmart, you know.
Yeah.
What very high percentage of their employees are on assistance,
mm-hmm.
and that's basically they're making the government subsidize.
Paying people a livable wage. Yeah.
Right. And so is that what the government's supposed to do? Because those are the dollars that I'd like to see. I want Walmart to be paying its people a livable wage. And then I want people with disabilities who deserve to have support from the government be accommodated at the level of their need.
Yeah.
And, yeah. And, you know, yeah. And we see it with insurance.
Because if Walmart paid their livable wage, then there would be plenty of money for disability benefits.
I mean, technically speaking, there's plenty of money already.
Yeah.
We don't really have to take from one disenfranchised group. I mean, that technically isn't. That's taking from someone who puts it all in three or four people's pocket.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, Bezos is the same way.
Mm-hmm.
If he one less yacht and Bezos yeah. could pay, you know, not only could they have bathroom breaks, but they could have health insurance. Go figure.
Yeah.
So I don't, you know, the perpetual model of we always have to make a profit and we always have to make more profit than we did last year. I'm just not sure how long that model can be sustained.
And Amazon's notorious and Walmart too for not having full-time employees.
Oh yeah, because then
they don't have to pay
other obligations. Benefits. Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they dodge all the other benefits stuff and, you know,
yeah, under the mess.
Essentially out of the table, you know?
Yeah.
Insurance, we can't get insurance. It's like, I'm not sure where it came from that insurance companies, if you go into like, say, PHP level of care,
mm-hmm.
they don't pay room and board because it's not quote unquote residential.
Mm-hmm.
The truth is you could make a really good program. You could make some really good programming out of resident, you know, for a care model with a room and board PHP style programming. And in Arizona, they're doing a model that's really working this way. They're shortening residential stays and they're putting people into PHP and really doing the clinical work there. But they, mm-hmm. you know, people still have to come up with the extra for housing. But for the people that you serve, like housing is like, it's 100% essential. Like these people, yeah. they can't get the care they need without the housing. Housing is the care.
Even our community-based program that we're working on rolling out later in the year, the housing's the key component there. Like the housing is everything centered around stable housing. And for the population we work with, like everything's centered around stable housing with that. So there's really no way, it never made sense to me why insurance companies have never made sense to me. Why is someone who's never met me determining my health progress and what treatments I'm going to receive?
And that are not an active care provider or
no, and they're, most of them are not physicians. Most of them are like paraprofessionals who are like reading off of a thing saying, okay, well, I'm just going off this criteria based on this criteria. Here's the coverage you're allowed to have rather than looking at the individual and the physician recommendation, especially in pharmaceutical, like especially in medications. But like how does an insurance company get to just say, well, housing's not necessary for this level of care when housing is a large component of what care is being provided? Like without the housing piece, the rest of it is, you can't do it.
And it's largely the same way for most of the levels of care after residential, even for people who are not doing long-term care environments.
Yeah, even if you're doing like if you're going into their houses and taking the care to them, like a PACT model, insurance doesn't cover that either. So like if it's not talk therapy or psychiatry, like prescribing.
Or group.
Or group, which... For the folks that I work with, as you know, talk therapy is not indicated. It's not an effective or an evidence-based tool. Groups are usually the same way. It's psychosocial rehabilitation that they need the most of, structure and support.
Structure
and education.
Support and community.
Yeah, and community. That's the biggest piece is community, people.
They get better about being with people when they're with people.
Yeah.
Go figure.
That's the biggest piece. I mean, I just mentioned music and mocktails, and you hear something like that, and it's like, well, where's the psychotherapy in that? There is no psychotherapy, but you take a suicidal person, put some really good music on, and put them in a room with other people who understand them, who look like them, who get it. And they leave there being like, I think I will just hang on till tomorrow because that was a good time.
Right. Because I don't feel awful now.
Yeah. I feel a lot better. Yeah.
Yeah. Little prop to Lakewood here, are getting ready. Let's see. Hold on. I think I have it here. The Legacy Gala.
Yes.
Is coming up.
October 3rd in Lakewood, Florida.
No, it says Friday, October 2nd. Is it Friday, October 3rd?
No, it's the 2nd. You're right.
It's the 2nd. Well,
you gotta go erase that.
You can be wrong, but if the paper's wrong, that becomes a problem.
No, the paper's right.
But,
fell on the 3rd.
Why are you having a gala? Because you're a nonprofit.
Yes.
Why are you a nonprofit? Because, you know, it very often, by the time a person reaches anywhere from 3 to 6 months to a year's worth of your care, mm-hmm. they're running out of their resources and they need you to subsidize mm-hmm. their ability to make it into a long-term stay.
Yeah.
There's another program with similar features out in Texas. And, you know, you've got people who are living in recovery from severe and persistent mental illness and even addictions issues for 5 and 10 and 15 years, and they're not going to the hospital mm-hmm. and they're taking their meds routinely and they're getting the amount of care that they need to support them at the level of independence they've achieved. And instead of like being in jail, being in the hospital repeatedly, 18 times a year or whatever it is, sometimes more mm-hmm. or, needing lawyers and public defenders and everything else to handle the stuff in addition to whatever damage they may be causing to people and properties and everything else. Mm-hmm. Like the math after a period of time is really a no-brainer.
Like, yeah. So according to our impact study in the state of Florida, to house or incarcerate and hospitalize repeatedly someone with, let's say, schizophrenia. So SPMI, pick your choice. I'll say schizophrenia. It's about $360,000 per year, and that's taxpayer funded, right? So for one individual. And I don't have the numbers, so I won't throw them out there about how many of those that we have each year. So even if someone paid full rate at Lakewood Center with no anything, it would be right around $120,000 a year. And I have a client here now who, prior to coming to us, in 1 year, he had 96 inpatient hospitalizations.
Oh my, that's a record. That's the record. Yes. I don't have
96 times he was involuntarily admitted to the hospital. So he spent over a quarter of his year in a hospital. And he would get out and there were a couple of arrests in there as well. And so he would get out of the hospital, have some adverse event, come off of his medications, wander off from family, was sleeping on the streets, all of these same things that you and I in our worlds hear all the time.
Using shelters who are also nonprofits, you know?
Yes. Has been here for 3 years with no hospitalization. And obviously no incarceration either. And that was the missing piece, was stable housing, community, a level of independence he was able to achieve and now is maintaining with our support, and gets to be, he has a job in our therapeutic work program here on campus. So he's making a little bit of money. Sister just had a child, so he gets to visit and be an uncle now, whereas before it was, well, I'm the guy that 96 times my family got the call that I'm back in the hospital because I pick whatever it was for that time. And so I think that the way that, when we look at public health, especially around mental health, we want to jump straight to these evidence-based things. When the evidence just shows us that basic needs have to be met first and accommodate those basic needs. And then we can move forward with addressing all of these other things if it's indicated for that person.
And, you know, the other thing, I keep asking this question, but it's like, well, where's the barrier here? It's like, so insurance companies and state funded agencies that are providing, you know, licensure and funding and everything else for entities like this, we, you know, you exist on what I would call, say, the fringes of the private pay industry. A lot of your folks are private pay. They can afford $20,000 a year for their individual to stay in your care. Mm-hmm. But they might ask for, you know, a break somewhere in that year's stay and need a break ongoing. And you're a nonprofit, so you're prepared to provide some of that. If we go to the community mental health system, you know, it's kind of the same thing as what the insurance are doing. Insurance does too. What we see in residential care and private pay care and everything else, or insurance billed care, they are under funding, under staffing, under training, under serving their communities that they are bidden to serve.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have enough room because they don't have enough staff. And even the people that are in their care are not receiving their care. I've got a client right now. He was in the care of the local man, the LME here, and they, had a lot of problems, got arrested a bunch, was in the hospital, up and down, it's homeless for weeks and months on end. All the things that happen to people with severe and persistent mental illness, inconsistent on meds, and finally was able to get him into a sober home. And he's been sober now for a year.
That's amazing.
He has a trust.
Mm-hmm.
The trust is able to cover. It's, you know, it's not an expensive sober home, but it's more than the average person can afford that's in that situation.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, with people around him to support him, he stays stable. He stays on his meds. He's not in the hospital. He hasn't been in the hospital a long time. Hasn't been incarcerated. We got all of his charges dismissed.
That's amazing.
So, you know, on the other side of that, we've got this person who's walking around, and even though they got the money, they can't get the services. When we went back and we said, hey, this person's doing well, they've been sober, et cetera, wondering if they could, you know, reengage and be assigned housing, et cetera. They wrote back, this is a direct quote from the LME. You can look up who they are in our area in Asheville, North Carolina, and you'll know exactly who I'm talking about. They said, this person is no longer, nor is he ever to be a client of ours. It's like, how can you be licensed and contracted by the state to provide care to individuals that meet this criteria and refuse care to a person that's in that criteria? I did not respond with this comment, which was, so you're telling me that you're prepared to give him the same level of services that you gave him when he was in your care. Is that right?
Yeah.
Because that's what they gave him, which was nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing. Well, he could do virtual IOP. He's on the street, man.
I think access to care, I think telehealth really improved a lot for access to care. I'm from East Tennessee. So there's like, I think two psychiatrists in the town I'm from. And so over 1 million people. So for two psychiatrists to manage that, I mean, I think that telehealth has really improved access to care, but I do think that payers, specifically Medicare, Medicaid, and private insurance, has landed in this space that they know it is way more cost effective for them. And so that's always the solution. They could do virtual, insert that here. And that's not always possible. So to your point, how's a homeless person going to have access to working internet and somewhere to sit for 3 hours? You got to keep it moving. You can't sit somewhere for 3 hours if you're a homeless person. And that's kind of my, I think the clubhouse model is fantastic. I don't understand why the unhoused people can't join and attend a clubhouse model. I won't say which one that I visited, but that I was, my mind was blown because it's a city where homelessness is really
rampant.
And so we say that homelessness and mental illness go hand in hand, or at least that's, you know, the narrative. But you can't go to the state-funded clubhouse if you're homeless, and you can't be homeless if you're, you know, you're not going to come out of homelessness if you have mental illness because you don't have the support you need. So it's just a broken system across the board. I know for our, you know, there is a program that is long-term residential for people right here in Central Florida, and it's our local LME, basically. But it has a 3-year max. So after 3 years, then what am I to do? Then where am I to go? On average, you could be waiting months to see a psychiatrist. So if I get Baker acted, or that's our involuntary hospitalization here. So if I go in under an involuntary hospitalization because I'm suicidal and they determine, okay, we're going to put you on antidepressants, we're going to put you on a mood stabilizer, we're going to give you 30 days worth, and then you need to follow up with an outpatient psychiatrist. And I don't know about when you get there, Mission Hospital, I don't know how Mission does it, but our local hospital is in, here's your piece of paper, call one. And you can call, all of those things on the piece of paper, and on average, you're going to be waiting 3 months. So I have 30 days of meds, and I'm going to wait 90 days to see a provider to refill my medications. So what am I really going to do is probably not even take the medications to begin with, or I'm going to run out in 30 days and end up back in the hospital again. I'm going to be right back there because I still haven't been able to see my provider.
Yo. We could talk about this other case that we just got through working with. And this is the other great thing.
Yeah.
Is that you got a person with advanced medical needs and, you know, a lot of complicated kind of medical stuff and needs. There's a lot of medications, there's wound care, there's all these things, mobility challenges, and needs a skilled nursing.
Mm-hmm.
Respite, essentially, you know, needs a couple of weeks in skilled nursing to make sure these things heal up and they can kind of literally, in this case, get back on their feet at least a little bit. And they got a drug test back that said this person had methamphetamines in their system, which may or may not be true. Sometimes you can get a false positive on methamphetamines, especially if you know, got a lot of polypharma going on.
Yeah.
You had a person on antibiotics, or there's all kinds of reasons why a drug test would come back. Right. They were taking Sudafed. You're going to get a methamphetamine read. Mm-hmm. What you need is a blood test so you can detect levels and determine and look at the meds that person is taking to say, oh, this is why that read is there because of this and everything else. Mm-hmm. But they don't do that. All they do is they look at methamphetamine or amphetamine on the registry of the drugs that had been tested and showed positive, and they refused her across the state to be in a skilled nursing facility. Now, did her medical needs go away? No, they didn't. So who do we sue for that? You know, who is refusing, you know, who with a duty to care is refusing to fulfill their duty to care? They were discharging. We didn't have time to turn around, but I swear, I said, like, we could sue the state because I think we should, or one of these facilities.
Then the responsibility is, well, let's put it back on a Lakewood Center who doesn't even have nursing care except once a week.
Right.
You solve it for this person. And it's like, well, you know, unless, let's say the methamphetamine, let's say it is positive for drug abuse reasons, right? Let's say that this person is using methamphetamine. And do you have meth dealers in your skilled nursing facilities? I mean,
you absolutely do.
But you know what I mean? Like, do you have a market where she can go purchase these things? Because we're telling you, this person quite literally cannot get about. That's why we need you for 7 to 10 days.
So they're gonna leave and get their meth somewhere. Right. They're gonna have a hard time.
And you know, people who use drugs need care still. I don't. Yeah. You know, it's Just because you do something that's not legal doesn't make you any more in need of care and support. Right. I was really surprised to hear that. That was something I didn't know and something new to add to my soapbox for later when it downloads. But and it's very disparaging and discouraging for people in that situation because it's, why bother? You don't believe me. Like, why bother? Why? What does it matter?
You've given me no place to go.
Yeah. No place to go. Of course I'm going to be angry and bitter because now what? Like,
might as well do meth again.
Yeah. But I mean, right. At least the meth dealers helped me out when I needed something.
They're very ready to take your money and help you out.
Absolutely. Yes. Good customer service at the meth house.
Right. They, you know, because of a family friend that we had who passed, a decade ago. It is the same in hospice. Like, we're going to drug test you and you can't, or you've got an addictions issue and we're not going to give you any of this particular painkiller because you've got an addictions issue in hospice.
So that's the other piece. And I, I'm getting my doctorate. And so I've been doing a lot of things, been doing a lot of research.
Are you done yet? Because I hear about this doctorate, but I don't, where are the results?
I'm just going to talk about it.
You don't sound any smarter to me. In fact, I think it's going the other way.
I think it's making me a lot less smart. My ability to analyze and reason is so exhausted that I just don't do it anymore.
I just stopped.
They used to be like, Sarah's so analytical. And now it's like, Sarah shows up. She arrives. We can depend on her to show up.
She's got the dark circles under her eyes.
She attends.
It's like I can see through her.
Well, I interviewed 9 different medical doctors that were not in psychiatry because I was especially interested to see how that these things are impacting providers who don't live in our world. And, I had a couple providers, like one was a gynecologist, and it was like, outside of your common, like occasional mother who's using drugs, like my prescribing and things like that have not been impacted. Like my patients haven't really been impacted by the opioid epidemic. And I'm like, has it not? Let's unpack that. If I have an ectopic pregnancy, one of the most painful things to happen, especially if a tube ruptures, and I have to have abdominal surgery, which is 3 incisions across my abdomen, similarly to a C-section. And for, not that it matters, I haven't had this, but I know people who have. I go home with 7 hydrocodones. That's enough to get me a day and a half. But you tell me that I have to be essentially bedridden for about 4 days. And then you also tell me I have to take this other medication that's going to cause my uterus to cramp and have basically you're going to put me in active labor for a few days. And I get 7 hydrocodone tablets. And I've never used drugs before. I'm not a drug addict. I've never even used an illicit drug. So don't say that the opioid epidemic doesn't impact you. Like because you're not addicted to it, prescribing practices have changed so much because pain management now is like people saying I'm in pain is no longer a reliable indicator of pain or a reason to treat pain. It's just, And so, the same could be said for what you're describing. So I was a drug user and now I'm in hospice and you're afraid I'm going to relapse. I have a week left to live.
Right.
I mean,
well, or it's the other way and the prescriber, you get 100 hydrocodone.
Yes.
They're like, yeah, you're going to need this till the cows come home. Just take,
you need this for 3 days. Yeah. Like, okay. I really just needed pain management around the clock for the 4 days. You told me I'm not going to be able to get out of bed because it's going to hurt so bad, but you give me 100.
Right. This doctor says that there's no problems. It's like, how often do you serve the clients after they're through with the pain? Because you're serving them for pregnancy. Mm-hmm. You may go in, you're doing the incisions and everything else. Like their OBGYN might have a different answer to this question.
Yeah.
But they might not even know because I bet they're finding all kinds of ways to get their script filled. And it might be illicit. In fact, my, one story that just kind of blew my mind was And this in particular is in Florida, as you might imagine. But there's a playground, and a certain time of day, not when the kids are out of school, but when they're still in school, you'll see a lot of vans lining up in the parking lot near this playground, not far from the school. Because why?
Because the mommies are exchanging pharmaceuticals.
They're exchanging pharmaceuticals, and they're getting dealt opiates. They're getting heroin off the street in the soccer soccer van, the mom van, and then going home and finishing out their day, and going picking up kids. Like it's the person you think of as an addict. There's no common picture anymore. It doesn't exist. But we still keep treating it like it's a pariah. And that, you know, if you do this, then you're excluded from other care. It's like, just because a person's an addict doesn't mean they don't need the other care that they need, including your compassion and your attention.
Or and pain management. It doesn't mean their pain management. Real. Yeah. And I don't know the statistics on this. I would really like to know, like, how many people are really still going to the doctor to get their opiates?
Right.
I mean, that's like a big problem. I mean, fentanyl is a huge problem here in Florida. And I mean, every vehicle that's registered.
You're not going to your GP for it.
No, every vehicle that's registered in my name has a box of Narcan in it. And, you know, because the parking lot, to your point, because the mommy's in their vans and it's always someone you don't expect, the parking lot is usually the number one place people overdose and in grocery stores. That was a study I'd read from a few years ago. And so, yeah, we carry Narcan. I don't know if I've ever had an opiate. I had to think back about it. Someone asked me the other day. I'm like, I'm not sure. But we carry that because you never know. But their pain, like, I don't know that anybody's, like, rolling up to the family doctor to, like, fulfill their heroin addiction.
Well, and I think you're naming the problem. You went and interviewed a doc, and the doc's like, well, there's no problem. You know,
it's it doesn't impact me one way or the next.
Right. So this doc lives in this silo and he gets to think he's right. He's not.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, in his experience, in his narrow little worldview of his patients, the no more than he sees them for the time that he sees them and for the condition that he sees them, he might be accurate. Well, it doesn't impact me. It doesn't impact my patients that I know of.
Right.
Because I don't look any further than when I'm talking to them for 15 minutes. And so you get these silos, and I'm a doctor, so I know things.
Yeah.
In fact, I know all the things.
Mm-hmm.
And that generally applies everywhere. I mean, if you go into a hospital, it's like, well, we don't need to know any of the history about the person. We're the doctor. We'll know things. It's like, did you know that they were allergic to the med that you prescribed them to, actually?
Because that happened
maybe
to
it
both
was
of
worth
us.
Looking at something because it that wasn't happened. On their, you know.
Yeah, that happened to the two of us as well recently.
Oh my gosh, right? Like,
oh, we didn't know she was allergic. Really? Because it was on the 10-page packet I sent with her.
Mm. Didn't look at that, did you?
No.
Not closely.
We don't need their thing. They're just that little program over in Fern Park. We don't need their feedback.
Right. So that's the problem that we have. I mean, we've got
fragmented care. Yeah. Right.
So how do we fix it?
We've fixed it for 52 people now. Here at Lakewood, we fixed it for 52 people.
So more Lakewoods, is that what you're telling me?
I think
you can
more
bring one up here. We need one up here.
We do that golf course, you know, if you're listening to this and you happen to have a property, give me a call. Todd will give you my number, right?
Oh, I think we can find you some property.
So I think the one thing that we try really hard to do, and I think that's missing is this one size fits all attitude, or like this is indicated for this condition. And I know I keep saying this, and I'm not hating on evidence-based principles because those are so important. We have to have somewhere to start, but that's where you start, not where you stay. And, you know, we have essentially in our extended care model adapted each person to whatever that needs to look like for them. So, you know, we may have somebody who never has talk therapy, but we may have somebody who has it every day. We have a podiatrist that comes out. Not everybody here sees the podiatrist, but I've worked at other programs where it was Everybody has to have diabetes education. Well, only three people have diabetes. Why is everybody having diabetes education? And so if we could find a way to disenfranchise one size fits all care, and yes, more extended care models that are affordable, that are funded.
Well, and crisis response care. I mean, I'm not saying that people don't get in crisis, but like all of our care is to intervene on a crisis and mm-hmm. then not do a whole lot after that.
No, because
if a person's gotten to a place where they've gotten in crisis,
there were things that led up to that. Yeah, it did. What's they that? Didn't just wake up in crisis. There were things that led up to that. And I also think that when I say funded, like we need more extended care models that are funded. We don't need to take the fun out of it either, or the quality, because that's a lot of the reason that we haven't been incredibly eager to accept state or federal funding, is because there's a lot of things that it would be, oh, we can't take them on a boat ride. They don't need a boat ride. You know what I mean? So like you have to really compromise your quality if you are receiving those dollars. And so I think that, you know, the providing needs to be left up to the providers, so that way we can be impactful in creating these models. But I would love to see a Lakewood in every community, not just, you know, the states that I love, but, you know, every community needs them. I think it is the solution. I think community integration is the solution for sure.
Well, and, you know, we were really pretty close to it in the 70s. I mean, we were doing it in the 70s.
Yes.
We were doing it, you know, in the 70s and even in the 80s. Then the 90s came around, and people who are working for insurance companies who are not professionals, not medical and or mental health professionals, mm-hmm. starting dictating what care should be. We're going to do it. Yeah. We're going to do it in this time frame. You're going to have these periods, et cetera, et cetera. I remember when it came down, and it really, really, really threw mental health for a loop. And mental health has never been true. Mental health care has never been truly functional on the public pay side.
Yeah.
But we were closer. We were closer 50 years ago than we are today, which is just a nutty thing for me to think about and say. On the private side, you got plenty of really good care, and we know what to do.
Yeah.
So we got a lot of sophisticated clinical models that already exist, that have already been proven, that they're using mm-hmm. regularly now. So you can insert a lot of like really fresh blood.
Yeah.
To a model that actually worked back in the 70s.
And it is cost effective. It's going to be way less than homelessness and incarceration.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, at Cooper East, the grounds that the second campus for Cooper East sits on
is yeah.
the Highland Center.
Yeah.
And it had a hospital and two phases of step down on campus.
Yeah.
And then an outpatient doctor's office at the end that they could get their scripts from. And it's like
right.
they had a complete model right there on campus. Mm-hmm. 1967, I believe.
Yeah.
And, you know, it eventually shut down because, well, in this case, their main building burned down.
I was going to say.
Killed Zelda Fitzgerald. But, but more importantly, entities came in and they said, no, this is too expensive. We don't want to.
Still a good example.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the biggest barrier. There's nothing more heartbreaking to me than having to tell someone I don't know. And we'll get calls sometimes. I'll fill in sometimes for admissions and families, how do people afford this? Because one thing that we never want to do here at Lakewood
is part of our expensive.
No, and part of our nonprofit, part of our model today, and I hope that, you know, people donate and we can fundraise huge dollars and we can bring people in on the front end with financial aid. But our model today is we never want finances to be the reason someone has to leave here. So we reserve those funds for after someone's been here for a period of time. And so, you know, you have people who will ask me, how do people afford this? What do I do? I don't have any money. And my answer to them is, I don't know, because I don't. I don't know how people are managing, and
they're going homeless or they're going to jail. I mean, we know how they're treated.
I know the alpha come. I don't have the outside of, I mean, I do have the solution. I don't know how to, I don't know how to make rubber stamp understand what we're doing here and make people pay for it. Make
right.
Those that be pay for it. Because the truth is society, we're all paying for it anyways. And, you know, you have people, I live in a suburb here in Orlando, and I'm on like the community pages on the internet, right? Like on Facebook or whatever.